everybody. Welcome to another Webtoon Wednesday. Jace here. Have a creator who I consider to be extremely talented here to talk about his latest Webtoon strip, which just launched last week. And we've had him on the show before to talk about the Eisner-nominated Alcoholic. So, Dean Haspel, welcome back to the show.
That's very kind of you, Jace. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. It's always good to see you. It's been a little bit. We were just talking about that.
Yeah, San Diego, I don't know, like what, almost a year ago, eight months ago?
Yeah.
Seven, maybe? I can't do the math.
Have you? Well,
but yeah, that's the last time I saw you.
Yeah, actually, were you at New York?
Oh, I was at New York Comic Con. It's possible. I mean, I always wander there at least.
Yeah.
You know, obviously it's my backyard.
Right.
So I might have even like high-fived you over there.
Yeah, exactly. I think for some reason all of a sudden it popped into my head that we like crossed paths but didn't get a chance to hang out. But we have in the past, so we'll definitely have to get together for a drink or something sometime soon.
Absolutely, man.
Yeah, and like I said, we've had you on before, but here's the thing, Dean. I've always interviewed you in a convention setting. We've never had more of this kind of relaxed atmosphere like we have now. And so I've never got to ask you the question that I always like to ask people when they come on for the first time, which is kind of how you got into this crazy world of comics. You know, did you grow up reading them? Like, what's your sort of secret origin with the comic book industry?
The origin, I believe, is starts with a newsstand in front of a church. And I'm not religious or anything, but I feel like I found my spirituality through comics in a way. Like, I grew up in the Upper West Side of New York. I live in Brooklyn now. I've been here about 22 years. But in the Upper West Side, I remember there was a newsstand across the street in front of a huge church. And I would go and I would spot comic books. And I don't know if someone handed me a comic book or I noticed the drawings and colors on one. And I do remember one of my earlier comic books was Shazam number one, when they couldn't call it Captain Marvel. And I think DC had just gotten the property from Fawcett or something in the early 70s.
Right, yeah.
And I believe Denny O'Neill wrote it and drawn by C.C. Beck, who was one of the co-creators of Shazam. And then little by small, it created a hunger. And I was voracious for comics. And I remember picking up the Fantastic Four, and suddenly there's a family of superheroes. And obviously there was like the Hulk and Spider-Man. I was a big Marvel fan. I love Batman 66 now, or that is, the Batman TV show now as an adult. But as a kid, I thought it was so corny that I didn't even pick up the Batman comic books because I thought it'd be the same kind of corniness,
Yeah.
And some of them were, obviously, But, years later, Frank Miller would, spark the Dark Knight, and he and Alan Moore would create that kind of grittier kind of, well, at least a gritty response to superheroes. I think they were commenting on superheroes, but then it became like a trend as we see these days. So it started with a newsstand and just comic books and picking up, Shazam, Fantastic Four, Marvel 2-in-1, drawn by Ron Wilson, that kind of stuff. And then I discovered the comic book shop. And that was like, that was a real church. Like, that was a room or, a store full of comic books. And then you would know what days they come out. So I would run to the newsstand on whatever day the new comics are dropped. And the same thing with comic shops and so on and so forth.
And then at what point did you start thinking about maybe taking that creative route for a career, comics or, graphic otherwise?
I think I decided at age 12, my dream was to one day pencil the Fantastic Four. So I went from like a real kind of youngster to, becoming 12 years old and suddenly became otherwise unemployable because I wanted to make comic books. But I would notice the assembly line in the credits. There's the writer, the penciler, the inker, so on and so forth. And I was like, okay, I'm going to be a penciler. I'm going to try to learn how to pencil. But I was still intimidated by comic books. I never thought I could draw like the artist that I was, looking at. So even though it was a dream to draw for Marvel or DC, I knew that I'd have to take a more alternative route, which is kind of what happened. I don't think I've ever really been good enough for the mainstream. And so I kind of tended toward, hopscotching and dipping my toes in the alternative, but it wasn't underground like R. Crumb or Zap Comics or anything like that. It was, you know, when I first got published, I believe it was like 1987, with a comic book called The Verdict that was co-created by writer Martin Powell. And yeah, I think I was leaning more toward the noir, and you know, I wasn't doing any kind of socially conscious kind of comics. I was still steeping in genre, kind of like crime stuff or a little bit of science fiction and romance. I started to realize that I, weirdly enough, I love romance comics, and I never really read a lot of good actual romance comics, but I like it when it's in the story, because I feel like that's the crux of any good story is a romance.
Yeah, but you bring up a good point, and you know, we have a lot of aspiring creators that listen to the podcast. I want to touch on something you said there. Just because your style may not be suited for the big two, you know, Marvel or DC or you know, right, traditional superhero comics, it doesn't mean you can't find your niche, because sometimes, you know, a different style, a unique look, a quirky look, it really can lean into the kind of stories that you're trying to tell and be an advantage for your style of storytelling, right?
I appreciate you saying that, because you don't know that at the time. You don't really necessarily know you have to pave your own lane, you know, like, because you want to be sanctioned, you know, editors hire you, or a publisher or an art director will hire you. But if you're, quote, not good enough, or you don't follow a certain kind of house style, don't forget, those earlier comics still kind of lean toward a house style. Like, even though Jack Kirby wasn't drawing all or laying out all the Marvel comics, it was still kind of like, you know, something you aspire to kind of do it like Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko. And then, it transitioned into like John Buscema, and then John Byrne and George Perez. So little by small, the shackles were being broken. But you could still see the influences of those earlier kind of comic book progenitors, you know? But, you know, I didn't really have the facility or the skill set to draw like that. And not because I didn't try. Maybe I wasn't ready, or maybe I just veered into a different direction because of whatever else might have been influencing me. And so it was really cool to see alternative comics. You know, I remember in the 80s meeting Evan Dorkin, and he was like doing, I think he was doing Milk and Cheese, or was it Pirate Corps or something like that for Eternity Comics. And, you know, you would meet like other artists that, you know, were more like the outliers, as it were, you know, again, not like the 60s stuff, the socially conscious political stuff. It was almost like starting to create your own little universe, which is kind of where I've gone with this Red Hook saga. You know, and I've also done this with Billy Dogma and some other comics I've worked on. But meanwhile, I'm still such a fan of the original text, you know, like Superman, Batman, you know, the Marvel era, the 1961 launch of, you know, anti-establishment comics. And, you know, I love that I'm able to contribute to that when I can. But now I'm building out my own universe.
Yeah, it's important, and especially for young creators, because sometimes it takes so long for creators to discover this, you know, to get where you're at, Dean, where you realize that, yeah, you've got to kind of plant your own flag and do your own thing. Yeah, you're going to be influenced.
You have to. And listen, now there's no excuses. When I was a kid, it was print, right? You know, an editor, an art director, a publisher would hire you based on what they thought, you know, if you could secure enough sales, because they had to spend money on print. Now you can use the internet. There's social networking. I mean, that's another lane that I carved, as kind of like an alternative outlier artist, was to use, Live Journal was where I did a lot of publishing of my comics. You know, I had this Billy Dogma series. I founded a webcomics collective called Activate in 2006. And that's where we would publish our comics once a week. And it kind of created this, like, this little community and culture of free web comics, you know, personal kind of stuff as well. And it wasn't necessarily meant to be commercial. You could take certain risks, you know. I'm still astounded. How can you write another new Batman story 80 years later? How did they do it? You know, I mean, it's a real job. But yeah, no, I think that any young creator, there is no excuse, you know, and it's different levels and different kinds of readers, more attracted to the visual medium than ever before.
Yeah, I agree. So you've heard it right here from the horse's mouth, you aspiring creators out there. Don't try to be the next.
And I think that certain Webtoon readers, the regular readers, because I just dip my toes. You know, I publish my comics. I've contributed to other series. I you know, read some of the whatever appeals to me at the time. But it really seems that there's an actual, like, voracious culture of readers on there. And I think that they have this sense that I'm like some Marvel guy who, you know, lives on a yacht and produces these comics. And no, I'm just struggling like everybody else.
Yeah, you're just out there trying to tell the stories that you have passion for.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
So don't try.
And that's the thing. Like, I hope that comes through, because otherwise, why am I doing this? You know, it's not like, you know, I might as well learn how to draw Batman better. Or Superman or whatever, and then try to, like, make a solid living that way. But instead, you know, I'm taking the risk of actually trying to dare to compete with, you know, the Marvel and DC cinematic universes and all the, and these legacy heroes that have been around forever, by trying to throw my hat in the ring and say, you know what, I have some superheroes too.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that it's not a matter of taking somebody else's spot at the table. It's just a matter of, there needs to be room for everybody at the table. There needs to be room for all these stories, because you're going to reach somebody that maybe isn't into the Marvel and DC kind of stuff. So
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, listen, I think what Hellboy's coming out, the new Hellboy movie's coming out. Yeah. That's a great example. You know, Mike Mignola created his own, you know, franchise after, you know, working at Marvel and DC. And that's a risk to take, right? Like, you know, who knows how that's going to do? And somehow it's hit. And now he's been, you know, this is the third movie being made of his character.
Yeah, so listeners, remember, don't try to be the next Todd McFarlane or the next Jim Lee or even the next Dean Haspiel. You just be the best you can be. And, you know, there are outlets. Like Dean said, there's no excuses. You can publish on Webtoons on the Discover site, and it doesn't cost you anything.
Yeah, you can publish on Webtoons. And you know, the more authentic, the better. You know, take risks. You know, we grow up online. I've been growing up in public for years. And, you know, you make mistakes, and you do start to cringe at some of the stuff that you've created. But that's because you're only getting, you're just growing and you're getting better, you know, and it's okay. And I think that, you know, to be as authentic as possible is the way to go.
Yeah, 100%. Well, let's transition into Starcross, which is, I guess, the third chapter of your New Brooklyn saga. Is that right?
That's right. It's well, actually, so there's a little confusion there. So it's the third season of The Red Hook.
Got it.
And Line Webtoon decided to split up the seasons into their own kind of, you know, character studies, as it were. And so the first season is The Red Hook that... Later on, I dubbed in print New Brooklyn, because that's where we introduced the idea of New Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And then that expanded out to two other series, The Brooklynite and The Purple Heart. So we had like these three concurrent series happening that was, you know, unleashing this new concept called New Brooklyn. And I live in Brooklyn. I've been here for about 22 years now. And you know, I'm a born and bred native New Yorker, and I fell in love with Brooklyn when I moved here. In fact, at the time, I felt like I was moving to the country. I could hear quiet again. It was bizarre, and there were trees and, you know, like nice neighborhoods, and the buildings were shorter and not so tall. And it just, there's a lot of community and neighborhoods, and it's a beautiful space. But as I, you know, became a freelance cartoonist, and, you know, trying to be my own entrepreneur, it's a difficult thing to do in a big city, especially an expensive city. And little by small, the studios were shrinking. They're becoming more expensive. And I just felt like at one point I was like, how am I going to survive in Brooklyn? And I started to think about, well, you know, what's going on with Brooklyn? And I described this for The Red Hook a couple of years ago, but just to jump the gun, I decided that, you know, maybe Brooklyn is sentient and her heart is broken by the toxicity of the world and some of the indifference and the apathy. And she decides to physically and literally secede from New York, ergo America, to start her own republic during a time where there's this cosmic dawn of like new heroes and villains that rise within its city. And then that's kind of the origin of you know, New Brooklyn. And then we had, you know, like I said, these other characters that, that rose from it. And then I started to tell the story of the Red Hook. He's basically a boxer who accidentally kills an opponent. He's exonerated, but then he's kind of hated. Then he becomes a thief, and he dresses up in this costume. He's dating this other thief called the Possum, and they're in love, and they live in Red Hook. And then suddenly there's this kind of like dispute between these two demigod lovers called the Green Point and the Invisible Light. And she's kind of going crazy, and she accidentally kills him. And while he's dying in his death throes, his last like 5 minutes of life, he wants to pass on the Omni Fist of Altruism, which is what he uses, and the secret sort of sacrifice. All this heady stuff that, that, you know, I'm kind of like winking at, like, kind of like these Jack Kirby ideas. And he basically bequeaths them upon this thief, the Red Hook, and forces him to become a superhero or he will die. So that's what a lot of like this first season is about. And they're able to, kind of save the earth from, you know, becoming extinct through, the power of the Invisible Light, who's going crazy and has the power to do that. But to the sacrifice of the Possum, who, spoiler, dies in season one, basically. But the way season one ends is that she's on, you know, the morgue table and her eyes open. So I kind of set up season two with War Cry, which is, have you had a chance to take a look at that or what that idea is about?
I've read the first three of Starcross. I'm in the middle of Red Hook right now, season one, but I haven't got to War Cry yet, but soon.
So for, you know, Webtoon listeners and whatnot, like, it would be great if you read season one, Red Hook, and season two, War Cry, but I do my best to try to catch you up in the, I think it's the second chapter of Starcross. And there's a lot to download or upload, information about what goes on in the last two seasons. But hopefully what it'll do is make, you know, readers want to go and actually read those comics because they're there and it's free and they're fun, you know? So then a whole other thing happens in War Cry where, the Possum is resurrected into a dual persona called Warcry, a human of mass destruction, where she shares this being with a teenage boy. And in a way, that's kind of my homage to Shazam, you know, Captain Marvel, Billy Batson, who shouts the word Shazam and becomes a superhero. And it's combined with another idea by a Jack Kirby character called OMAC, One Man Army Corps.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what I was playing with there. And then, the Green Point kind of comes back, is kind of semi-resurrected, and he wants his power back. So that's what that story becomes. But the end of season two, War Cry, she is kidnapped by, this huge giant cosmic hand, from a character called an Omni God. And we're like, what the hell is an Omni God? So now Starcross is going to, explain what the hell happened to her, because it starts a year later, a year after War Cry, and some things have changed. New Brooklyn has grown. The Red Hook misses his, you know, his resurrected lover, but she's gone, you know, to the winds of space. And then a character comes back and warns that that the sun is dying. And the Red Hook has to save the world.
Yeah,
it becomes a little crazy.
it sounds crazy. It sounds wild. It sounds fun. And it sounds a little bit different than the things that I know you for, which is more the kind of slice of life things. But it sounds like a lot of these ideas that that you're talking about here, you know, you mentioned Jack Kirby. It really comes out of your love for not only the medium of comics, but, you know, growing up reading these superhero stories. So it was time to kind of create your own superhero universe, right?
Yeah, luckily I've, you know, done my time. I'm at the art table every day. I've worked on a lot of other people's properties. I've collaborated with writers where I was, quote, just the artist, you know. And little by small, I was like, I had these stories in my head and I started to write them down. And So as I was improving as a storyteller and as an artist, I was now developing as a writer. And as we know in comics, image is text. You know, it's all, to me, comics is all narrative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're always not just necessarily telling a story, you're showing a story. And so I eventually was able to pitch my ideas, like the ones I've just explained, and be able to, you know, not only pay homage to the artists and writers that I loved growing up, but also do kind of like a new modern spin on these ideas and mashing things up. And, you know, I love having conversations with other creators where I'm learning about what they love and what they do. And then, you know, how their influences are impacting their stories and their art.
It sounds like this, and it's okay if it's not, but you let me know, Dean. It sounds like this is maybe the most fun you've had doing comics. Is that the case?
It's right now, the last few years producing this Red Hook saga for Line Webtoon has absolutely been the most fun. I'm in this weird autonomous space where they just, you know, no one told me, no one says no to me. And not because I'm a diva or I'm like the greatest writer artist ever. I think that what's really cool is that they believe in me. And I attribute a lot of that also to Tom Akel, who was my editor. And it's been so much fun that I'm afraid of what's going to happen when I draw the last page of StarCraft. I don't want to go back to reality.
Yeah, and I think, you know, having read comics for 40 plus years myself, you can tell when a creator is really having a lot of fun, when it's, you know, an idea or a story or characters that they're passionate about, because it comes through in the art. It almost seems
absolutely,
like it's effortless in a way.
Well, it's you know, at some point, again, it's all about developing, because, you know, when you're younger, you just like what you like and you haven't fine-tuned it or figured it out yet, what it is or how to express it. And little by small, you just stick with it and you just keep writing it. I mean, another thing I realize is that I revisit certain trends in my work. I keep kind of tackling the same kind of ideas. And it's not because I'm trying to get it right. It's just that maybe they're such big ideas that they're fruitful and you can, you know, do different versions of these ideas over and over again.
Yeah, and it certainly works for this. And I like the idea of you really, you know, we talk so much about location or setting as a character. Mm-hmm. And you've really taken that to the mm-hmm. next level. You know, clearly you love Brooklyn. And like you said, you've taken it, or like I said, you've taken it to the next level in terms of, you know, setting as a character and even made her sentient. So was that always at the heart of the story to begin with, or was it the characters or the universe? Like,
I'm glad you recognize that. I think that, you know, I had this idea for the Red Hook. In fact, my original name for him was the Rascal, and I still may play with an idea called the Rascal. But then because I kept visiting Red Hook, I live in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, but right next door is Red Hook. And I was just like, yeah, you know, I love the name Red Hook. And I started to realize, well, maybe this character, and I had been working on a character called the Fox for Archie Comics. I plotted and drew about 10 issues of the Fox. And what got me the job doing the Fox was this character sketch I did that looked more like a red Fox, because the Fox is like a black and blue costume, and it was almost like kind of like an audition, but I kept returning to this character, and then I realized, okay, I have a character, and he's like a super thief, and, you know, he's going to become a reluctant superhero, but to me that was like, well, what's original about that? That's a dime a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And what locked it in for me was to incorporate Brooklyn as a character. And I've mentioned Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and C.C. Beck, but another famous classic cartoonist, Will Eisner, who created The Spirit, he was great at incorporating like landscape and buildings and being able to find the personality and the characterizations of those spaces and tenements and whatnot. And, you know, when you walk around the streets of any big city, there is a lot of personality. And I was able to identify that and somehow incorporate that into the story. And I feel like that's what made it different and locked it in for me for the Red Hook.
Yeah, and it works so well in the story, and this isn't necessarily specific to Brooklyn, but there are so many different places all across the country, all across the world, really, where the inhabitants of those places really identify it and think of it as its own kind of unique person and love it and revere it and maybe put it on a little bit of a pedestal above other places, maybe to the point of it being a little bit of an isolationist viewpoint. I haven't read all the story yet. I'll get there. But is that something sure. that you wanted to explore, or is it just kind of a byproduct of the story that you wanted to tell?
Maybe not isolationist view, although I can understand. Listen, I've been to New Orleans. Whenever I go to New Orleans, I'm like, oh my God, I want to live here.
Yeah.
People might say that about Paris. You know, certainly people feel that way about California. There's certain places in the world where, like, why would you ever leave? And, I've never had the opportunity to go to New York City for the first time because I've grown up here. And I've met so many people that are like, oh, I remember the first time I came to New York, and they would tell this story about what it was like. And I don't know what that's like, because I've been spoiled by New York City in so many ways, like the fact that you can basically get anything you want here, any kind of food, music, art, culture. I mean, yes, there are certain things that identify any place on its own, and it is probably more pure coming from that home or that space. But I get a really good version of it here in New York City,
Right.
I haven't really had the desire to have to leave it, except for financial reasons, because it is difficult to live in New York City, because it does have a gravitational pull. It's a magnet for all cultures and all kinds of people to come here. And I've only benefited from that.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. I can remember the first time I went to New York, and it wasn't what I I'd expected. You hear these stories.
Where were you coming from when you first visited New York? What was your regular digs?
So I grew up in California, 40 years in California. I had only been living in Phoenix, where I'm at now, for a few years when I had to go to New York for my job. And yeah, I expected not to like it, just because I'm not really much of one for crowds.
Yeah.
And crowded spaces. And you hear all these rumors about rude New Yorkers, but man, I loved it. I loved it. I've been back since, and I always look for. I look forward to going now. It's like if anybody from my day job ever has to go to New York, I'm like, I'll go. I'll volunteer.
I'll do it. Yeah. You raise your hand.
Exactly.
Yeah. I actually felt that way about California for many, many, many years. I almost had like an allergic reaction to it, and I was like, I don't want to go to California. And it looked very different in the movies and. As much as I enjoy like stories and stuff, I was like, I had no desire to visit. And there were a few times as a kid that I went and I was like, whatever. And it may have been where I went to in California, to be honest.
Right.
But the last 3 to 4 years I've visited, specifically like Los Feliz, Silver Lake, real cool parts of LA. I'm like, ooh, wait a second. I get it. I think I understand. I mean, I'm not a car culture guy. I can't stand sitting in a car for more than 5 minutes, but then again, there's a lot of people who probably don't want to, ride a subway either.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm starting to dig it. I'm starting to like California. I've actually said out loud that I would even consider moving there someday.
Yeah, California has a certain vibe, but a bit more laid back. There's an energy to New York that I sensed right away the first time I was there, and I feel like that's part of what you're capturing in these new Brooklyn stories.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, there's a lot of manic energy in my comics, and maybe that is partially because I'm a New Yorker. Although it's hard for me to recognize that, but I believe you.
Yeah, well, like you said, you kind of get used to it, and kind of the same thing about California. Me having grown up there, when people talk, like you said, worldwide, right? California is known. People want to go to California,
yeah.
And I always find myself going, "Really? That's where you want to go? You could go anywhere. You're going to go there? What's the big deal?" But it's all perspective.
Well, we get used to it. We get used to our spaces.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you did mention earlier, Dean, about not sure what's going to happen when you draw that last strip for Starcross. Do you have that planned as the end of the line for New Brooklyn, or would you maybe return to it?
To me, it feels like a trilogy, right? So this particular Starcross will end a certain trilogy of story. But I already have 2 to 3 other epic kind of Red Hook stories I want to tell, meaning more long form, like these 26 chapter comics, as well as a bunch of just little shorties, you know, like not every story is like gigantic, of course. So the good news is that I've actually come up with a lot of other ideas. And if this does well enough, I would love to do a fourth story or more of the Red Hook saga, you know, online webtoon, but we'll have to see. So yeah, this particular story is a trilogy. I'll call it, the possum's name is Ava Bloom. So I tell her story through the eyes, and ears of the Red Hook and what's going on with New Brooklyn and all the other characters. And that will basically wrap up one story, but then I have so many more.
Yeah.
And then otherwise, you know, I've written some plays. I'm hoping to mount another play or two that I'm currently writing. There's another character I used to write and draw called Billy Dogma, the last romantic antihero. And I would like to revisit Billy Dogma as well. So I don't know, maybe I'd take a break and do some Billy Dogma. And you never know, maybe I'll also do something for Marvel and DC. I don't know.
Yeah, when you're a freelancer, you got to keep
I just
want to
keep writing and drawing these comics.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. You got to keep all your options open. But I will say, as much as I'm enjoying, you know, discovering the Red Hook trilogy and diving into that, I'm also curious in the back of my mind, when I saw that, you know, that moment when Brooklyn split apart, it would be cool to do like an anthology set in this world. Like, how did everybody else around the world react when Brooklyn like split?
That's
up.
Great, because I do, you know, basically hint at what happened with New Brooklyn and then quickly focus on the Red Hook and his plight and the possum and everything else that goes on that kind of goes off the rails and gets really super heroic and crazy. But there is so many stories to tell, like what happened in New Brooklyn. And, you know, I've talked to Vito Del Sante, the co-creator and writer of the Purple Heart, about telling more stories about New Brooklyn with the Purple Heart. I've talked to my other buddy, Adam McGovern, who's a writer of comics, and he and Paolo Leandre came up with a character called Aquaria. And Aquaria is kind of like New Brooklyn's water character, even though Aquaria's never appeared on Line Webtoon proper. She's kind of made little cameos in the back, like in a water in the somewhere, you know, snuck in there in the artwork. And they produce some short comics and they're telling other kinds of stories, loosely tethered to New Brooklyn. And then I've talked to about a handful of other creators who are coming up with other ideas to kind of expand on this idea in this world. And, God, I would love to do that. And I literally have notes about how to do an anthology. Whether that will work out online webtoon or via a print publisher or somewhere else, I don't know. I mean, you know, a lot of this has to do with funding. You know, I make a living at this right now. I mean, I just squeak by on it, but it's why I'm able to make this happen. And if we could somehow convince, you know, either Line Webtoon or whoever to help perpetuate and continue this concept, I would love to do that.
Yeah, again, well, it's like we're talking about, right? You have so much fun doing it. You have passion for it. If you get to bring your friends in to play in the universe that you've created, that only is going to perpetuate that. You know, you're having fun doing it. The work is going to be better for that reason. Same thing with your friends. You know, they get to come and play in this world you created. They're going to have fun, you know, creating with their friends.
They tell ideas that I would never even think of,
right,
you know,
exactly.
and you just got to make sure. It's almost like I'm the showrunner, you know, showrunner in television, where they conceive an initial idea and then they work with other writers and they blow it up and expand it. I feel like that's what I am with New Brooklyn. It's kind of like I could be a showrunner, you know? And there's so many more ideas to explore because of the fact that I'm just hinting at certain stuff, and it makes people like you or other readers start to wonder, well, you know, what else is going on? And, you know, or maybe you'd want to contribute and make something happen. You know, that's what Marvel Comics did for me. I sometimes look at the dawn of this New Brooklyn universe akin to Marvel Comics from 1961 to 1963, that 2-year period where they came up with so many of the core ideas that we love today.
Yeah, so listeners, not only do you need to be checking out these awesome stories, make sure you tell your friends about it. Hey, I discovered this, even if they're not a comic reader, because guess what? It's online Webtoon and it's free. It doesn't cost them anything.
It's free.
And we've all
it's
got
on your phone. It's already in your hand.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. We all have a comic reader in our pocket now because Line Webtoon, it's beautiful on your phone. I wanted to ask you, Dean, about kind of the look of the story and leveraging the vertical scroll of Line Webtoon, which is very, very unique. You know, you don't see that in print. I haven't seen it on a digital comic before. And you're really taking advantage, especially in the first few episodes of Starcross, where we're getting these long panels of like these cosmic scenes. You really are taking advantage of. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, thank you. It's been quite a challenge, believe it or not, because, you know, I come from print comics, and early on I would try to figure out how to exploit, you know, the real estate of the blank page, you know, 11 by or 10 by 15, you know, 11 by 17 size, you know, the tall rectangle. And then figure out how to play with that, and you get to double page spreads. And like, I use these insets that I learned, you know, from Howard Chaykin when I was his assistant. I also assisted Bill Sienkiewicz and Walt Simonson, all 1985. And that was like a heady time for me. And all three of those guys like do wonderful, wonderful things in comics and, you know, visualizing story. So, you know, I would start to kind of arrive at my own ideas of how to tackle narrative in this space. And then suddenly I'm being asked to basically draw an entire vertical scroll for a chapter where you just pull, you know, you drag the story with the pull of your thumb. And I had to really think about, well, how does that work? And what does that look like? And obviously I looked at other Line Webtoon comics at first. And then because I also knew that I wanted to put these comics in print eventually, I tried to figure out how do I draw it for print first, but then cut it up, you know, for the vertical scroll that would actually be published first, right? And then in print later on. And so it's been a real challenge, and trying to innovate. Well, how do we read and look at, you know, these pages, you know? And what I, one of the things I realized is that a lot of the reveals, a lot of the visual kind of like, you know, little milestones or cliffhangers happen at the bottom of the panel. Mm-hmm. Or as you keep pulling up, the story's happening at the bottom. So I had to think about how that might look also on, you know, the regular printed page and try to navigate between the two. And then sometimes I do a little surgery, a little editing, you know, obviously when I'm cutting up the artwork and creating this magical kind of scroll. And it's been really, it's been fun and a little bit of a struggle, to be honest.
Well, that's something that we always say as creators, right? That we want to keep challenging ourselves and learning and growing. You always want to keep improving. You don't want to stagnate. But I suppose in this way, you're almost being forced to if you're moving to Webtoon. So in a way, we talked earlier about somebody who's an aspiring creator who maybe hasn't done anything professionally yet, going to the Discover site of Webtoon and doing something there. It may be easier for somebody who hasn't already done the print work or the published work, right?
Well, the easier thing to do is to not care about print. Start there. Don't worry about the print version, you know, especially as the world goes more and more digital. And especially if you're an aspiring artist. Now, I would say, try to create your comics at a high res level, meaning at a print, you know, resolution, and then, you know, reduce it eventually for online, because you never know if you want to try and print that later in some fashion, right?
Yep.
But meanwhile, take advantage of this format. When I first started doing web comics in 2006, I just drew squares. I literally just drew one square after another, and I knew I would figure it out later if I put it in print. So, you know, and I was also thinking about the phones we had then, which were, you know, had more of a square screen, you know, when we started to get these flip phones. And I thought, well, maybe one day we'll look at comics that way. But still, when you put it all together, you would get the size of a regular print page. And then I was also thinking about, you know, oh, left to right. Maybe, you know, there were some comics that you know, came out when they came out online or on the web. You could go from left to right. And it was like this. Was it unlimited or this kind of infinity? You could go as long as you wanted to, right? Mm-hmm. And same thing with the scroll, if you wanted to just give it that latitude. But then Webtoons came around, and I don't know that they're the first ones to do the vertical scroll, but it was the first time I had ever seen the vertical scroll. And again, if you're just starting out as a web cartoonist, you can just draw squares or tall panels and just do one after the other. And don't worry about being, you know, too clever, because sometimes that can get a little messy. But then figure out how it works and why you might go with a really long panel, or what kind of ambience you're trying to show or not show.
Yeah, I think it's important to not use it as an excuse. If you want, you know, be the thing you want to be. If you want to create comics, then like Dean has said, it's easier than ever before, you know, to get out there, self-publish, put it on Webtoon or whatever. The important thing is just to do it, you know, to prove to yourself that you can do it. You can keep a deadline, and to prove to everybody else, if you want to get your foot in the door, it's a great way.
So, and like I said, don't worry about making mistakes in public, because that's what we all do.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's like, how we learn.
You can't win them all.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, have you built a pretty good fan following? It's one thing that a lot of Webtoon creators I've talked to really enjoy, that there's not, unlike a print comic where you kind of have to go out looking for the reaction or kind of, you know, how people respond. Right here in Webtoon, right, it's like right there at the bottom of the episode, right in the comment section. So have you built a pretty good following and community of fans?
I've had a pretty good, like, I mean, obviously I've gotten readers I never would have had, you know, at Line Webtoon, because of how, again, the community that already exists there. And it's interesting to see who likes it and who doesn't like it, who's trolling, who's a jerk, who really does, you know, is delighted in the work. And that's all really cool. I'm used to a more spirited dialogue that we used to have at Activate, where people would talk about the narrative and kind of guess what was going to happen next. And, you know, that kind of stuff. That's less so here, mm-hmm. but it might be more of a younger audience. And again, I guess in some ways I'm trying to appeal to a younger audience. And I'm hoping, though, that I'm dragging some of my readers. I mean, listen, I'm going to be 52 in May. You know, I'm a little bit older.
Right.
And I've been doing this for a while. So I'm hoping that some of my older friends are going to, you know, pick, you know, do subscribe to the app and do check out the comic in this format, and enjoy it in this way. But yeah, it's been an interesting time to, you know, see who is responding to this right now.
Yeah, well, that's part of the reason that I got involved with doing the Webtoon Wednesdays, is because, yeah, their audience skews a little more toward female than male, and it's a younger reading audience. There's not a
lot
of...
That's great. I mean, that's amazing. I love that.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's just not a lot of the traditional comic readers like you and I who grew up reading it who even realize that this exists. And the fact that it's there's, you know, any number of... Any genre you can think of is on there, and it's all free, and there are great stories like... You
know, I know.
Red Hood.
I know. It's kind of insane, to be honest, yeah. Because when I first did Activate in 2006, and, you know, it was on this LiveJournal platform, and I would tell people, like, yeah, you can read the comics. And they're like, how much does it cost? I was like, no, it's free. I'm like, what are you doing? I was like, well, I'm trying to make another comic while I work on these other jobs. You know, I mean, one of the reasons that I did that was because I'd be lucky enough to score a gig where, like, let's say I was working on a graphic novel with Harvey Pekar, Jonathan Ames, or whoever else. But you disappear for a year.
Mm-hmm.
You literally are working on a project that, you know, nobody sees. You might show a couple pages of art to your friends or whatever, but that's it. And you know, and then it comes out, and you hope that it does really well, but maybe you only get like 1 to 3 weeks worth of some play on it, and then that's it. And unless it's Watchmen or Dark Knight, it kind of disappears.
Yep.
So that can be very frustrating. So while I was working on, you know, a book that nobody could see for a year or so, I realized, all right, man, I got to do a comic on a weekly basis. And whether it was just a little funny comic strip where you do 2 or 3 panels a week, or you're kind of creating a serialized narrative, which is what I did with Billy Dogma on Activate, you know, then once a week, I was kind of honing my skills, my auteur skills, you know, the author in me, and trying to see what works, you know, and see how people would respond in real time. And what I didn't realize at the time until it was too late, was like, I'm actually producing 2 graphic novels at the same time.
Yeah.
You know? And then eventually I could put in print the stuff that I put online for free. And sometimes I do think about the comics I do on you know, the webcomics would do, is that maybe they're kind of like the first version, and you have an opportunity later to kind of edit and refine, you know, some of the artwork or a piece of dialogue or maybe a story bit before you put it in print, you know, and in a way, you're engaging the reader to kind of be there for the first version of this stuff.
Yeah, and it's again building that, having that built-in audience, so that when it, you know, if you do decide to take it somewhere else, print or what have you, you know, you have those people that enjoyed it one way and then can get it a different way, and you know, hopefully you're kind of bridging the gap between traditional versus digital.
And if you were to read the print version of the Red Hook and compare it to the digital, you know, line webtoon version, they actually feel different. They actually kind of pace and read differently, mm-hmm. but they're the exact same story.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It just goes into how our brains work, which we're not going to get into here, but it's an interesting thing to think about for sure.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned you're a little bit older, and that kind of applies to the other webtoon creators as well. A lot of the webtoon creators I've had on Webtoon Wednesday, it's, you know, they're younger, they're maybe still in college and they're doing this on the side, or, you know, it's the first podcast right. they've ever done or first interview. It's been really kind of fun for me to sort of in some way be their first interview and kind of mentor them and give them advice. Have you had a chance to?
Oh, I would have been a nervous wreck if I had, like, I mean, it's incredible right now. Like, you're talking about, you know, young new cartoonists that are like either still in college or just left college, and they're being published online and creating, a fan base and telling their stories and getting responses and then being interviewed by you. I mean, that's it's incredible right now what's going on.
Yeah, some of them with tens of thousands of subscribers. It's kind of crazy. Have you had a chance to?
I know.
Have you had?
I'm jealous.
You'll get there, Dean. You'll get there. Don't worry. But have you had a chance to?
Someday I'll make it.
Have you had a chance to meet any of the younger creators, and have they asked for advice? Have you networked with other?
Yeah, I've met some of the younger creators at like the Comic Cons, and they're all sweethearts, and they're totally cool.
Have any of them asked for advice, or is it more let's just hang out and have some?
They don't want advice from an old guy like me. No, but, you know, maybe it's because, you know, everyone's kind of standing around, you know, thinking, oh my God, I can't believe we're doing this. We're actually, you know, able to make, you know, a living at this stuff or making comics, but, you know, and everyone's coming from a different point of view, I believe, you know, so I don't know if it's, I know when I was younger, I always asked older people advice, like, how do you do this? Or, you know, how did you get here? Or what did you learn? And, you know, I guess I'm not around young people enough for them to be asking me that question.
Yeah. It might just be a product of the environment, because, yeah, I totally agree with you. It's so much we can learn, right? So I'm always interested.
Oh, there's so much we can learn. And luckily, like this interview we're having right now, or, you know, there's so many interviews being done and people expressing themselves through essays and articles and everything else. You can type in probably your favorite artist, and there probably is an interview, and you can, you know, get hip to their wares or find out more of their process. And there are also process videos happening all the time. I mean, it's incredible how much it's blown up and expanded, you know, the industry and the forum.
Yeah. And you're pretty active online, right? And available if somebody wants to reach out for advice, you know, social media, those kind of things.
Yep. Right? Twitter's not my favorite thing, but I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And what I like about Facebook, even though it's, I don't know, evil corporation or whatever these days, but there's more opportunity to actually have like a dialogue, you know, with folks. Instagram is more visual. And Twitter is a little more toxic
definitely. So I'll put links to Dean's social media in the show notes. So if anybody wants to reach out or follow him, find out when new projects coming out. So yeah, Dean, it's been great having you. Best of luck with Starcrossed. I'm definitely going to read the entire trilogy, get caught up. I'll shoot you a quick note, let you know my thoughts.
Thank you so much, Jace. And thanks for talking to me about it. And I hope, your Webtoons listeners, check it out as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you've never seen Dean's work, his style of visuals is so kinetic. It's one of those kind of styles that just brings a smile to my face and reminds me, like, yeah, this is what's cool about comics. You know, different artists have different styles.
Oh, thank you so much.
And there's room for everybody. So as we sign off here, Dean, I wanted to give you a chance. Anything else to share? Any other projects you're working on? Anything else that you want to plug?
That's about it. Right now I'm doing Starcross. Oh, I'm also doing a weekly podcast with Josh Neufeld, where it's called Scene by Scene with Josh and Dean. It's, I think, scenebyscenepodcast.com, where we take Harvey Pekar's American Splendor, the movie, and we break it down scene by scene. But we also talk about indie comics, web comics, you know, our relationship with Harvey Pekar and the work we did with him, as well as our own friendship growing up together, making comics.
So basically what you're saying is we as listeners just get to eavesdrop while you and Josh sit around and have the same conversations you've been having your entire friendship.
Absolutely. And using the vessel of a movie, that this really cool movie that if anybody, your listeners have not seen, please go check out American Splendor, the movie, which is about a comic book writer.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti does an incredible job. He's like channeling Harvey.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Absolutely. So,
definitely. Well, thanks again, Dean, for joining me. It's always good to chat with you, and hopefully we'll see each other soon. You'll be at San Diego, I'm assuming?
You know, I don't know if I'm going to make it this year to San Diego, and I was there last year, but I hadn't been there in 11 years. So there's a chance. But I will be at Baltimore Comic Con, and I will absolutely be wandering around New York Comic Con.
All right. Well, I'm not going to be at Baltimore, but I will be at New York. So if nothing else, we'll meet up then.
Cool, man. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.